Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 390, recorded on July 25th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining me on the line from New York is Kelly. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So we've talked on many episodes about the relationship between the U.S. government and leftists in the United States during and shortly after World War I, as well as the early U.S.-Soviet relations. But we haven't previously talked about the U.S. military's most direct involvement on the subject, the doomed boots-on-the-ground intervention in the Russian Civil War. That's the subject of this week's episode. Let's start with the background chronology leading up to that intervention. In the beginning of 1917, nearly 3 years into World War I, and just weeks ahead of the official U.S. entry into the war, Russia began to experience a revolution. The liberal reformers tried to keep the war effort going, but this proved so untenable for a variety of reasons that the Russian lines began collapsing backward across what is now Eastern Europe, and the communist Bolshevik faction seized power at the end of the year with the promise of an immediate end to the Russian war effort. By this point, the United States had entered the war on the Western Front, bolstering unsteady French allies, but they were too late to prevent the complete withdrawal of Russia from World War I in December 1917 by a separate armistice with the Central Powers. Russia then devolved into a full-scale civil war between various pro-Bolshevik, anti-Bolshevik, and unaligned eccentric factions or cliques. Germany proceeded to occupy large sections of the former Russian Empire, but mostly began redeploying its eastern forces into the Western Front. In March 1918, the German Empire threw almost everything it had at the Allies in France and Belgium during the so-called German Spring Offensive or Ludendorff Offensive, hoping one big lurch forward could end the war in a draw before the United States could fully spin up its gigantic war machine potential. By July 1918, however, this offensive had theoretically gained a bunch of ground, but primarily had simply stalled out at great cost and left Germany essentially too weak to hold off the Americans and the British in the coming counteroffensive that would end the war in German defeat by November 1918. With the German push stopped in July 1918, some of the Allies, without much American enthusiasm, were trying to figure out if they could get the communists out of power in Russia and restore a pro-Western military command willing to re-enter the war on the Eastern Front for one final pincer on Germany. With extreme reluctance, in the summer of 1918, the Americans found themselves getting dragged into this underdeveloped plan to interfere in the Russian Civil War and to take part in the other Allied powers' great game activities in the former Russian sphere. The last U.S. troops would depart, having been assigned very little and having achieved very little, by the spring of 1920, less than 2 years later, and more than 3 years before the Russian Civil War drew to a close. The two primary locations of these U.S. military interventions, which would nevertheless unsurprisingly sour relations between the U.S. government and the victorious Bolshevik Russians for some years to come, were in the Russian Far East and subpolar northwest Russia. Kelly is going to talk about one, and Rachel is going to talk about the other. Before we get to that, though, I will also note that I've included in the written notes for this episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com, but I will not be reading today from the U.S. document on the scope of the intervention. The summary of that is that in July 1918, shortly before U.S. deployment, President Wilson had the State Department circulate an unofficial document to the other Allied governments defining the scope of the upcoming American military operations in Russia extremely narrowly to focus on securing Allied war materiel and assisting the Czechoslovak Legion, and expressing extreme skepticism about the likely prospects of this intervention, while advising that it would not interfere with other allies in their own plans, except if it violated Russian sovereignty more broadly. There were vague allusions to helping organize a self-determined Russian state, but this was the least emphasized aspect. So, Kelly, I will start with you on the timetable of the Siberian Russian Far East intervention by the Americans, which lasted from August of 1918 before the end of World War One to April 1920. So could you tell us a little bit about the U.S. intervention in Siberia and the Pacific coast of Russia?
Sure. So the U.S.'s intervention in the far east of Russia primarily was centered around Vladivostok, which is a port city on the Pacific Ocean in the far east of Russia. Apologies to any Russian speakers who I'm sure would correct my pronunciation of Vladivostok. The mission here was commanded by General William S. Graves, and it involved just under 8,000 men in total. Graves, in his position, believed that the purpose of his mission was to protect American supplied property and to help the Czechoslovak Legion evacuate. He did not believe that it was his troops' role to directly engage in fighting against the Bolsheviks, which actually put him at odds with leaders of the British, French, and Japanese forces in the region who wanted the U.S. to take a more active role in the military intervention in Siberia. Historians, like we will talk about for many reasons throughout the show, disagree about what the exact intention of this intervention was, but all agreement is that it was a failure. So we'll talk about a number of reasons that Wilson got engaged. It still is, the decision is quite confusing in retrospect and even for folks at the moment. I thought it was interesting that when reading about this topic, language such as Graves believed his purpose or Graves believed the mission was quite revealing, because even in the U.S. military, different commanders were apparently believed their missions were different. It goes without saying that living in Siberia was pretty miserable and dangerous. So there were shortages of food, supplies, fuel. Horses that they had brought that were used to temperate climates were simply not able to function and survive in this cold. And all told, in the Far East mission, 189 soldiers died from all causes, including illness, freezing, and of course, the military activity itself. But I'm going to read a quick note here from the Wikipedia page. By every measure, President Wilson's interventions in Russia had failed. The Eastern Front had not been reestablished. The war supplies stockpiled in Russian ports had not been saved. And no popular progressive non-communist government had been established. The Japanese continued to meddle in Siberian affairs for another 2 years in a futile effort to carve out a puppet state. Even the successful extrication of the Czech Legion had little to do with Graves' small expedition. In the words of Chief of Staff Peyton C. March, the expeditions in Russia had been little more than a military crime. And so while it ended in sort of dismal terms here, as expressed in that quote, the reasons it began were many, perhaps, or at least the reasons listed. Of course, throughout all of this is an anti-communist sentiment that exists in the United States. But beyond that, there was three things that we're going to talk about here. The first was the Japan factor and Americans' overall fear that Japan would fill a power vacuum in Siberia and in Russia in general. The second was the Czechoslovaks, which was a unique legion of sort of volunteer fighters of Czech and Slovak armed forces that the United States was interested in preserving and getting out safely from Russia. And the third was the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which was a very important American investment and just critical to overall success in any sort of military intervention in Russia at the time. So to start us off with Japan, in August 1918, the American Expeditionary Force in Siberia began arriving in the Pacific Russian port of Vladivostok for operations alongside primarily the Allied Japanese forces. Less out of concern for the struggles of the right-wing anti-communist Russian forces in the area, and more out of concern that Japan might try to seize on the chaos to make a substantial land grab against its former regional rival. Less than a decade and a half after the shocking Japanese military victory over Russia, for which the U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt had ended up negotiating the peace treaty in 1905. Given the harsh climate of Russia, it was pretty incredible what the Japanese accomplished there in the Japanese-Russo War. that ended with the peace treaty in 1905. And Americans became and remained very concerned about Japanese interests in Russia and what might happen if there was sort of a power vacuum that the Japanese could fill in Russia, given that the Japanese had proven that their military was capable of success in this harsh climate. The Japanese had been asked in 1917 by the French to intervene in Russia, but had declined. In 1918, Wilson asked the Japanese to send 7,000 troops as part of an international coalition. Japan declined to participate in this international coalition, but instead sent 12,000 troops under its own command. The force eventually grew to 70,000 Japanese troops, much larger than anything else the Allies were deploying. So this is one of the many contradictions that we'll talk about today throughout the episode. One of the reasons that America got involved was that they didn't want Japan to be there and fill a power vacuum, but it still made sense for them to, given Japan's success in the region and military might, for them to ask Japan to sort of get involved with them in this international coalition, sort of thinking that that would keep Japan in check. Japan instead decides that they are going to get involved, but on their own terms. And the reasons for this Japanese involvement in the region were fairly poorly defined, just like the American reasons. It was both militarily and politically a failure for Japan, whose army was dragged for misrepresenting the size of the force and the amount of money spent on the effort. The Japanese military was in the region for longer than their counterparts and did not withdraw until 1922. And despite having this much larger force and staying for a few additional years, at the end of the day, didn't really have anything to show for it, so to speak, and certainly was not considered a success by the Japanese people. Another important factor in the Americans' involvement was the Czechoslovaks and their legion, which was a unique feature of World War I. This legion was a group of Czech and Slovak armed forces that sided with the Allied powers during World War I in hopes of winning support for independence of Bohemia and Moravia from the Austrian Empire. This Czechoslovak legion started as a volunteer force, but grew into a very mighty force of 100,000 and grew to include prisoners of war, of war deserters from the Austro-Hungarian army. So in other words, what had begun simply as a group of people fighting for the Allied powers in hopes of winning support, sort of philosophically opting into this, became a much more serious force when they began to force prisoners of war and others to fight alongside them. In 1917, the Czechoslovak Legion began planning their departure from Russia to France to continue to fight the Central Powers and began to travel to the Pacific port of Vladivostok in order to make this move. However, the German military soon launched Operation Faustschlag, or First Strike, and they were essentially stuck. So it was not their original intention to fight the Bolsheviks. However, their only exit from the country was to go through the Pacific port. They wanted to get over back to France and continue fighting the Central Powers in a military conflict more aligned to World War I than what was happening over here in Russia. And so it was not their original intention to fight the Bolsheviks, but they needed to do so in order to survive. And I'm going to read a passage here just to sort of give you an idea of the tensions in the region and how this group became so involved in the fighting in the Soviet Russia. After leaving Ukraine and entering Soviet Russia, representatives from the Czechoslovak National Council continued to negotiate with Bolshevik authorities in Moscow and Penza to iron out the details of the Corps' evacuation. On the 25th of March, the two sides signed the Penza Agreement, in which the Legionnaires were to surrender most of their weapons in exchange for unmolested passage to Vladivostok. Tensions continued to mount, however, as each side distrusted the other. The Bolsheviks, despite the order for the Legionnaires to remain neutral in Russia's affairs, suspected the Czechoslovaks might join their counter-revolutionary enemies in the borderlands. Meanwhile, the Legionnaires were wary of the Czechoslovak communists who were trying to subvert the Corps. They also suspected the Bolsheviks were being pressured by the Central Powers to stall movement towards Vladivostok. So the Czechoslovaks have a pretty long journey ahead of them, obviously through Siberia into this eastern port. And they believe that they are being undermined by revolutionaries in their core, which who are being influenced by the Bolsheviks. And the Bolsheviks believe that they are not truly neutral, and it is not the case that they're just trying to get from one point to the other, but believe that they may be counter-revolutionaries. And so this sort of this goes on for a number of months, fighting between the Czechoslovak Legion and Bolsheviks erupted at several points along the Trans-Siberian Railway in the last days of May 1918. By June, the two sides were fighting along the railway route from Penza to Krasnoyarsk. By the end of the month, Legionnaires under General Mikhail Detyerkis had taken control of Vladivostok, overthrowing the local Bolshevik administration. And on July 6th, the Legion declared the city to be an Allied protectorate. And so this sort of continues on and on, this fighting, largely along the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which we'll talk about in just a moment. This intention to not get involved in the Bolsheviks just was not possible as the Legion traveled across their territory. And one important note here is that this Czechoslovak Legion was a precursor to an independent Czechoslovakia. And in order for the Allies to establish Czechoslovakia, as they likely intended to do at this point of fighting in World War One, they really needed this Legion to survive. This was going to be the army that established an independent Czechoslovakia. And it ended up being the army that did establish the Czechoslovakia. So 1/3 of the initial Czechoslovakian army came from this Legion. And nearly all of the initial leadership positions within that army were held by people who had served in the Czechoslovak Legion. And so the United States in this case was looking down the line a couple years, looking to establish this independent Czechoslovakia, and knew that that was not going to be impossible if these troops who were stuck in Siberia did not survive. Another item worth mentioning is that the United States' involvement was partially due to this Trans-Siberian Railroad, which had been established and which Americans believed had nearly $1 billion of guns and other American equipment on it that had sort of been like scattered there, stuck there during the war. And the Americans wanted to retain control of this railway, get their supplies out, use this railway to help get the Czechoslovak Legion out. And this was a very critical piece of any success that was to be in military activity in Russia. So in addition to these nearly 8,000 military men, the Americans also formed what they called the Russian Railway Service Corps, which was made of 285 men from various railway companies. They were not initially military men, but were sort of given military privileges and eventually even named to be veterans. These folks came in to control and operate the railroad, not fight for it, because control of the railroad and the ability to operate it was key to any military operation in Russia at the time. It gave you the opportunity to traverse and carry supplies across Siberia, which of course we know is an incredibly inhospitable environment. And as we've spoken about, the railroad was key to the maneuvers of the Czechoslovak Legion. Bill, I believe you had a few other notes on this portion of the intervention.
Yes. So as Kelly has noted, the American intervention in Siberia was very amorphous and bizarre even at the time, didn't really accomplish its goals. It certainly didn't, you know, limit Japanese interference. It did not secure the railroad. It didn't really have much to do with the rescue of the Czechoslovak Legion, which mostly had to do that itself, and, you know, had already started arriving in Vladivostok before the Americans got there and so forth. So in that regard, this was, you know, a confusing failure. But I think it's worth noting that the operation in Siberia could have gone much worse, not just in terms of the casualties and the pointlessness of it all, but in the sense that the U.S. troops could have but did not become overly involved in helping out the ghoulish, brutal White Russia anti-communist commanders or their rampaging Cossack forces in the Russian Far East. And a lot of that is down to General William Graves himself, as Kelly noted, resisting getting his troops embroiled more deeply into that aspect of the conflict. because it was not something he had been directly ordered to help out with, but it was also implied that he could have potentially if he had wanted to, or the conditions on the ground had merited such an action. So I wanted to read some quotes here from a Smithsonian Magazine article from February 2019, which we'll be returning to at several points throughout this episode. Wilson decided to keep U.S. troops in Siberia to use the Trans-Siberian Railway to arm the White Russians, and because he feared that Japan, a fellow allied nation that had flooded eastern Siberia with 72,000 troops, wanted to take over the region and the railroad. Graves and his soldiers persevered, but they found that America's erstwhile allies in Siberia posed the greatest danger. Sticking to Wilson's stated, though disingenuous, goal of non-intervention in the Russian Civil War, Graves resisted pressure from other allies, Britain, France, Japan, and the White Russians, to arrest and fight Bolsheviks in Siberia. Wilson and Baker backed him up, but the Japanese didn't want the U.S. troops there, and with Graves not taking their side, neither did the White Russians. And there's some further elaboration in this article about the Far East political-military situation. In November 1918, an authoritarian White Russian admiral, Alexander Kolchak, overthrew a provisional government in Siberia that the Czechs had supported. With that and the war in Europe over, the Czechs stopped fighting the Red Army, wanting instead to return to their newly independent homeland. Now Graves was left to maintain a delicate balance, keep the Trans-Siberian Railway open to ferry secret military aid to Kolchak, without outright joining the Russian Civil War. Across Siberia, Kolchak's forces launched a reign of terror, including executions and torture. Especially brutal were Kolchak's commanders in the Far East, Cossack generals Grigory Semenov and Ivan Kalmykov. Their troops, under the protection of Japanese troops, were roaming the country like wild animals, killing and robbing the people, Graves wrote in his memoir. If questions were asked about these brutal murders, the reply was that the people murdered were Bolsheviks, and this explanation apparently satisfied the world. Semenov, who took to harassing Americans along the Trans-Siberian Railway, commanded armored trains with names such as the Merciless, the Destroyer, and the Terrible. Just when the Americans and the White Russian bandits seemed on the verge of open warfare, Bolsheviks began to win the Russian Civil War. In January 1920, near defeat, Kolchak asked the Czech Legion for protection. Appalled at his crimes, the Czechs instead turned Kolchak over to the Red Army in exchange for safe passage home, and a Bolshevik firing squad executed him in February. In January 1920, the Wilson administration ordered U.S. troops out of Siberia, citing unstable civil authority and frequent local military interference with the railway. Graves completed the withdrawal on April 1, 1920, having lost 189 men. Now, before we move on to the other element, Kelly, I want to pause here and give you the opportunity to reflect on any other points that you haven't made yet that you wanted to make, or observations that you wanted to make about the American intervention in Siberia and the Russian Far East.
We spent a sort of number of minutes amongst ourselves talking before we pressed record just about the number of contradictions and confusing pieces here. This from the start, this intervention never really quite made sense, which is why historians still talk about why this really happened. And so I think that it is a largely forgotten piece of American military history, in part because it was such a blunder. And I think that it's just important to reflect and try to understand these pieces.
Now, Rachel, we're going to turn to you now for the shorter duration operation, but arguably the even more disastrous one, from September 1918 to July 1919. And this was on the other side of the country in Russia. For some reason, I guess they thought they were going to link up these operations to each other eventually. That was never even remotely within the realm of possibility, as I guess you'll be able to elaborate for us. But this one is, even more of a failure in many regards, and certainly much more of a disaster for the Americans. So why don't you fill us in a little bit more on the what later came to be known as the Polar Bear Offensive of the 339th U.S. Army Regiment in Archangel.
Right. So while the troops were involved on the east, there were approximately 5,000 American troops who arrived in the subarctic Northwest on the White Sea coast. And they arrived in September 1918 to join an increasingly aimless and overwhelmed British force that was attempting since March of 1918 to guard the port of Archangel from both the Bolsheviks and the newly nominally independent but German-dominated Finland. So, as was the case in Vladivostok in the Far East, an unfortunate volume of Allied war materials had arrived in the port shortly before the Bolshevik coup and Russian exit from the war, and the Allies wanted to prevent anyone else from capturing those supplies. But by the time the Americans actually arrived in the fall of 1918 in Archangel to help the British, French, Australians, Canadians, and Italians, this goal was basically too late to accomplish, and the Bolsheviks had already made off with most of the Allied supply caches. The British commanders, with much more expansive goals, then attempted to use the American troops to push south against the Bolsheviks to mount a breakout from their isolated coastal position and somehow link up with the Czechoslovak Legion troops that were traversing Siberia from west to east. So this ended up putting the Americans into direct offensive combat against the Bolshevik forces, which was against what the Wilson administration had wanted. But this advance stalled, and the Allies realized the local population was thoroughly uninterested in mobilizing to support this effort, which seems like a very optimistic pipe dream on the part of the Allies. The troops never reached anywhere near the Czechoslovaks from this direction, and the Bolsheviks counterattacked in winter, devastating the Allied troops, going against what everyone who has ever played Risk has learned: don't conduct an offensive in Russia over the winter. So by this time, the troops were extremely demoralized, and as World War I had ended in the West on November 11th during this Bolshevik counteroffensive, they were now wondering why on earth they were there and how they were supposed to evacuate with the Arctic Ocean frozen over winter. Probably the only reason they weren't annihilated was because they were much better trained and equipped than nearby Red Army forces typically were. After the armistice, family and friends of these expeditionary force troops called for them to be brought home. They wrote letters to newspapers and petitioned their congressmen. And so the newspapers published op-eds calling for the recall of the troops, and congressmen questioned why they were there. And we'll expand on that later. Meanwhile, with morale so low, rumors of mutinies abounded. The British doubled down, sending relief troops in the spring when the ice cleared, but the American commanders outside of Russia worked quickly to arrange for the Americans to evacuate through Archangel by the summer of 1919. So there was an Alaska Daily Empire article on the return of the 339th Regiment that was published in July 15th, 1919. When the first troops came home from Russia. Quote, "With steel helmets of white above their ruddy faces, 46 officers and 1,495 men of the 339th Infantry, first American troops home from service in northern Russia, arrived in Hoboken aboard the Von Steuben. The 339th is the regiment about which the mutiny story, which aroused nationwide comment, was circulated several months ago. Pure bunk was the characterization of the story by Major J. Brooks Nichols, wealthy Detroit manufacturer and clubman who was in command of the returning troops. More bunk has been published about the North Russia expedition than any phase of the war," said Major Nichols. "What gave rise to the story that Company 1 of the regiment had mutinied was an incident in which an order was misunderstood by a soldier who could not understand English well." And we discussed this prior to recording. I kind of forgot that this is still a time of open immigration. There was a huge number of immigrants that were fighting in the war that probably didn't speak English very well, or spoke broken English, very limited English. So it was very possible that an order could be misunderstood by soldiers that just couldn't understand the language. The rest of the AEF did get disbanded in August 1919, so it was a very quick withdrawal, much sooner than happened in the Siberia front. There was a Tuscaloosa News article published 10 years later. Many bodies of the people who died there, the troops that died there, were not disinterred and repatriated back to the United States. So Quoting from this Tuscaloosa News article, a year after all of the expedition members had returned home, in 1920, polar bear veterans began lobbying their state and federal governments to obtain funds and the necessary approvals to retrieve the bodies of at least 125 of their fellow American soldiers, which were then believed to have been buried in Russia and left behind. By that time, 112 sets of remains had already been transferred to the United States. By 1929, additional research found that 226 fallen polar bears had originally been buried in North Russia, with a total of approximately 130 sets of U.S. soldier remains then estimated to still be buried in North Russia. Hampered by the lack of diplomatic recognition between the United States and the Soviet Union, it took many years before they finally received permission. An expedition under the auspices of the Veterans of Foreign Wars was successful in organizing and conducting a recovery mission in the autumn of 1929 that found, identified, and brought out the remains of 86 U.S. soldiers. And so this Tuscaloosa News article talked really glowingly about five veterans from the 339th who basically took it upon themselves to search for the bodies of these remaining soldiers. It definitely kind of wrote about it in a romantic sort of way. They were riding on horseback, conducting the research, searching, poring over maps to find the remains of their fallen comrades. So it definitely, it didn't sugarcoat the fact that it was somewhat futile, that they died over in North Russia, but it did romanticize the search of the veterans to find these remains. So 14 remains of these expeditionary forces were shipped by the Soviet Union to the U.S. in 1934, which reduced the number of U.S. soldiers still buried in North Russia to about 30. And I didn't see that the rest of these 30 ever really made it back. I'm sure in the vast expanse of North Russia, it was quite difficult to find all the remaining bodies that were over there. So as we mentioned earlier, during the entire operation in Northwest Russia, there was virtually no contact or communication between the American troops trapped there and the American troops in the Russian Far East. And going back to that Smithsonian Magazine article about this, the U.S. soldiers in northern Russia were chosen for the deployment because they were mostly from Michigan, so military commanders figured they could handle the war zone's extreme cold. Their training in England included a lesson from Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton on surviving below zero conditions. The Bolsheviks' January 1919 offensive against American troops in North Russia, which began with a deadly attack on Meade's platoon, attracted attention in newspapers across the nation. For 7 days, the polar bears, outnumbered 8-1, retreated north under fire from several villages along the Vaga River. On February 9th, a Chicago Tribune political cartoon depicted a giant Russian bear, blood dripping from its mouth, confronting a much smaller soldier holding the U.S. flag. At its mercy, the caption read. On February 14th, Hiram Johnson's resolution challenging the U.S. deployment in North Russia failed by one vote in the Senate, with Vice President Thomas Marshall breaking a tie to defeat it. Days later, Secretary of War Baker announced that the polar bears would sail home, quote, at the earliest possible moment that weather in the spring will permit, unquote. Once the frozen White Sea thawed and Archangel's port reopened. Though Bolshevik attacks continued through May, the last polar bears left Archangel on June 15, 1919. Their 9-month campaign had cost them 235 men. Quote, when the last battalion set sail from Archangel, not a soldier knew, no, not even vaguely, why he had fought or why he was going now, and why his comrades were left behind, so many of them beneath the wooden crosses, end quote, wrote Lieutenant John Cudahy of the 339th Regiment in his book Archangel. So it was much more brutal, short, and it was very clear that the mission was a failure. It seems like they Washington took much swifter action to pull troops out of the Northwest Russia front versus the Far East Russia front. So to kind of expand on Lieutenant John Cudahy, he served with distinction during combat with the Bolsheviks in November 1918. In 1924, he published a book under a pseudonym entitled Archangel, the American War with Russia, in which he sharply criticized the U.S. military intervention in Northwest Russia. He dedicated the book to a sergeant killed in action in March 1919, before the arrival of the American rescue icebreakers, and he compared his criticism to General Ulysses Grant's disgust with the Mexican-American War. Lieutenant Cudahy was the son of a Milwaukee-based Irish-American meatpacking magnate, and he ended up serving as FDR's ambassador to Poland, then Ireland, and then briefly Belgium and Luxembourg until the Nazis invaded. In June 1941, just ahead of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, Ambassador Cudahy was commissioned by Life magazine to interview Hitler in Bavaria, which the publication emphasized was clearly intended by Hitler to convince the American public not to worry about his intentions despite FDR's escalating warnings, which Life magazine published alongside the interview. Cudahy then wrote a memoir shortly before his death in a horse riding accident in 1943. So John Cudahy wrote pretty scathingly of his experience in Archangel, and it was pretty clear, even in the introduction chapter, just how much the troops really saw how futile it was that they were even there in the first place. So I'm going to quote a short passage from his introduction chapter of Archangel. Whether there was any political connection between the Archangel expedition and the Vladivostok expedition is for the statesman to answer. Surely there never was any military connection. Obviously, there never could be any support or communication between the two forces, and the American soldier at the Arctic Circle who was not told the reasons why he faced death and unknown dangers there, and why he was weakened and broken, and made old by privation and intense cold, never knew that there was a Siberian expedition, and does not know even to this day. The soldier asked his officers why he fought, and why he was facing an enemy vastly superior to him in strength and equipment and armament, and why he was separated from his family and home and the ways of life, and when the end would come. But his officers were silent under this inquisition. They asked the same questions themselves, and got no reply. The colonel who commanded this fated regiment told his soldiers that he could give no reason for them to oppose the enemy, other than that their lives and those of the whole expedition depended upon successful resistance. So the morale amongst the troops was definitely low, because it was very clear that they had already failed in their goal from the very beginning. Even upon their arrival, they had already failed in their goal. The Bolsheviks had already raided these stocks of material and already taken off with them. And so there really was no point for them to be there. And their retreat was completely cut off due to the ice and the sea and the ocean. So there was just nothing for them to do except suffer under their wartime rations and the cold, and just kind of wait until the spring, which is understandably very demoralizing. So it was very interesting to research this expeditionary force and just see how misguided our involvement in this in the Russian Civil War really was.
I noted as well that the withdrawal in the Archangel expedition happened before Wilson's stroke, and then he apparently kind of tried to double down on the Siberia expedition instead of withdrawing, even though it was pretty obvious that was also failing. It was just, I guess, less violently failing. But the troops in Siberia and the Far East were not withdrawn until after Wilson had been incapacitated and other people were making the decisions. I do want to offer one concluding thought, quoted from that February 2019 Smithsonian Magazine article. Historians tend to see Wilson's decision to send troops to Russia as one of his worst wartime decisions, and a foreshadowing of other poorly planned American interventions in foreign countries in the century since. It didn't really achieve anything. It was ill-conceived, says James Carl Nelson of the Polar Bear Expedition. The lessons were there that could have been applied in Vietnam and could have been applied in Iraq. I also thought it was interesting when you were talking about Ambassador Cudahy's interview with Hitler, which was right before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. I wonder what he thought about that, like as soon as that became public and happened a few weeks later. And that was the thing that, you know, eventually stopped and turned back the tide of the Nazi expansion, was getting stuck in a winter war in Western Russia. I wonder what he thought about that. So I guess I'll go back to Kelly at this point to just get some thoughts, since you were focused on the Far East one, if you wanted to offer any observations based on what Rachel's talked about with the Western operation out of Archangel, and then we can go back to Rachel and do the same in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think the basic lack of understanding of Russian geography really stands out here, to think that at any point, anyone leading the U.S. military thought that these two different efforts were going to, like, convene and combine. That just really, that stands out to me. Like, and to what Bill just said about all of the lessons here to be learned, I mean, really the lack of an exit strategy, or the lack of, you know, a definition of success, really set this mission up for failure from the very beginning.
Rachel, I'll go back to you as well. You know, your thoughts on both this and the Siberian expedition that Kelly talked about.
Well, to just kind of repeat what Kelly said, there wasn't really defined goals or a definition of success that could have come true. It does seem that there were more goals in the Siberian force that they could have had success, I guess, but just the fact that nothing they did really gave rise to anything resembling a successful outcome. It's just interesting that the Siberian front lasted so much longer than the Archangel front, even despite the failures on both coasts. And I just kind of wanted to emphasize that last sentence from the historians. The lessons were there that could have been applied in Vietnam and could have been applied in Iraq. And I just finished reading the Jakarta Method. And basically, that sentence was spoken by Frank Wisner Jr., who was the son of secret covert actions starting in World War II. It's interesting to note that there seems to be a real ignorance of history and failures to apply historical lessons to future military actions. So it's something that I think we'll be doomed to repeat, just because we seem to fail to learn from these lessons of meddling in anti-communist missions. It's just something that keeps biting us over and over again.
It's interesting to me as well how public this intervention was, these two operations in Russia, that there was, you know, newspaper campaigns and letter writing campaigns and a Senate resolution debating at least one of them and so forth, as opposed to some of these other covert operations and so on. I obviously didn't really talk contextually because I wanted to keep the episode from getting too long about what else was going on at the time with regard to, you know, Haiti and the Dominican Republic and so forth. And we done an episode about U.S. military activities in Mexico around the same time, that kind of thing. But this was sort of a remarkably public failure. I also find it very interesting that they seemed to be getting, despite their inability to make contact between the two U.S. expeditions in Russia, the failures of the Archangel expedition, which was the most cut off and isolated of all of them, seemed to be getting out in almost real time to the American press. And you have to really raise an eyebrow at that, because the guy who was commanding the Red Army forces in the area against the Allied expedition trying to break out of Archangel was Trotsky. Presumably, he had control over a lot of the outgoing communications, telegraphs, things like that. And you have to wonder if there was a strategic decision made somewhere by somebody to let word of the disastrous failures and, you know, near annihilation that was potentially on the horizon for this Archangel expedition to be getting out in real time and getting back to the American public. I just found that to be particularly interesting to speculate about. Also, one final piece of contextual thing. I just wanted to note a few months ago, Rachel and I had done an episode on the USAT Buford, also known as the Red Ark or the Soviet Ark. And that dropped off the deported dissidents or alleged dissidents to Russia via Finland in several months after this expedition had ended. So you have to also wonder how that played into the determination to make those fairly unfair deportations of Russian Americans to the Soviet-controlled areas in northwest Russia. Maybe this was sort of retaliation for what had happened with the polar bear expedition. I don't know. But I thought that was interesting. That was in December of 1919, so about half a year after the withdrawal of troops from Archangel. I also think that, to Rachel's earlier point, one of the reasons the Siberia expedition seems to last longer is because they were at least able to pretend they were accomplishing something for longer, and they always had a way to leave if they needed to. Whereas by the time the troops get to Archangel, the mission's already pointless, and then the British commanders insist on trying to break them out of Archangel instead of just staying put until the ice had cleared, which probably would have been the much safer play. But for some reason, they thought they were going to push all the way south to the Trans-Siberian Railroad and link up with everything from there, which was kind of delusional. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about the U.S. military operations in Vladivostok, Siberia, and the Russian Far East during and after World War I.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for being on to talk about the polar bear offensive in Archangel in northwest subarctic Russia during and after World War I.
Thanks. It was a very interesting topic to research.